what to do.
This holiday season, you may be celebrating with champagne, wine, or beer. Hard to believe that it was just 80 years ago when Prohibition was repealed and drinking alcohol became legal again. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first part of our program, we'll talk with historian Tim Walch about the forces in this country that led to Prohibition, what it was like to live in Iowa during that time, and why that law was reversed. A Bonnie and Clyde miniseries appeared on TV this week. In the second part of our program, we'll talk with historian Rod Stanley of Panora about a famous Iowa shootout involving Bonnie and Clyde. First, though, we'll fire this news at you. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. This holiday season, you may be celebrating with champagne, wine, or beer. When you raise that glass, think of this. Hard to believe, isn't it? Just 80 years ago, Prohibition was repealed. Drinking alcohol became legal again, producing it in this country. 80 years ago this month, in 1933, the 21st Amendment repealed federal prohibition, which had been put in place by the 18th Amendment back in 1920. So originally making liquor illegal was intended to prevent crime, drunkenness, but it soon became clear that prohibition did just the opposite. As illegal speakeasies became prevalent, bootlegging essentially led to the establishment of organized crime in the United States. Of course, we all know the name Al Capone. Joining me to talk about the forces in this country that led to prohibition, what it was like to live in Iowa during that time, and why the law was finally reversed. So we welcome back to our studio historian Tim Walch, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walch, great to see you on this cold day.
Thanks, Ben and Ben.
All right. Tell us, in the lead up to this new law that was enacted in 1920, what were the forces at work in the early part of the 20th century? We're right at the end of the First World War. Why did the 18th Amendment happen?
Well, and the 18th Amendment, Ben, didn't spring out of nowhere. In effect, alcohol had been an important and controversial part of the American Republic really since the 18th century. You have to keep in mind that water was often tainted and led to a lot of disease, and it was much safer to drink alcoholic drinks to, in effect, get the liquids you needed. And so a great many people had beer on a regular basis and wine and so forth. But beginning about 1820, social reformers began to realize that alcoholism, drunkenness obviously led to reduction in productivity, that people felt that it was ungodly. And so the movement, the temperance movement to encourage people to give up alcohol begins in about 1826. It gains momentum in 1840. 1869, you have the Women's Christian Temperance Union is founded very early here in Iowa. And so evangelical Protestant groups begin to push for it, women in particular concerned about their husbands. And it becomes a rural-urban conflict, too, because many immigrants coming into this country from Germany, from other parts of Europe, were used to having beer on a daily basis, regular basis. And so saloons begin to emerge in large cities. But in the small towns of Iowa and other states, there was resistance to alcohol. And it culminates during that time in World War I. We're trying to increase productivity in our factories. People like Henry Ford begin to support the idea of sobriety and temperance. You have women becoming more active. And you have a push for those three amendments. First of all, the income tax, which helped reduce other forms of taxes. You have the women's vote, and you have temperance, kind of all good social movements all at the same time. And, of course, the 18th Amendment passes in 1917, I believe it is.
Okay, enacted.
Enacted in 1920.
In 1920. I was so surprised, Tim Walch, to learn that Iowa was one of three states that really led the way to this, and had you been living in the early part of the century in Iowa, you would have had it illegal as of 1916.
That's correct.
Four years before the national prohibition, we had prohibition in this state.
Maine, Kansas, and Iowa really led the way, and they were very active in the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The whole idea that it was unseemly and unfortunate if you were seen in public and inebriated, so that there was a lot of social pressure in the state of Iowa to not to drink. It wasn't illegal until 1916, but finally it culminates in 1916 and then across the nation. It was very popular. People shouldn't presume that the 18th Amendment was forced on America. It was thought of as the noble experiment. Let us try to aspire to a higher order of living and get rid of demon rum. What we fail to realize, though, particularly in those large urban cities, because by 1920, half of America is in urban cities, that those saloons were a kind of poor man's social club. And if you worked in a factory, you wanted to have a beer or a drink and to convene and enjoy the company of your friends. It was also a place where if you bought a beer for a nickel, you got a free lunch. Of course, what's interesting is those saloons were often affiliated with a single brewery, and those lunches were very salty, so you rarely got away with a single beer. But beer was part, and saloons were part of our culture. You mentioned earlier about Al Capone. It's said that he controlled as many as 10,000 saloons, or excuse me, 10,000 speakeasies during Prohibition.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm having a hard time imagining this. You have a drinking culture. It becomes popular, the idea of getting rid of this drinking culture, having a higher level of living. So this is enacted. And what happens to the breweries, the wineries, the distilleries? Are they just destroyed?
No, they're shifting over to what's called near beer, which was non-alcoholic beer. They might have shifted over to soda pop and other forms of beverages. So legitimately, they could not produce alcoholic drinks. They could produce wine for religious ceremonies and that sort of thing, but very, very limited. So they really had to scramble. It's also true that we have to keep in mind the Volstead Act, which is really the implementation of the 18th Amendment, allowed individuals to brew as much as or to distill as much as 200 gallons a year of wine or cider for their own use. So it's not as if people had to go cold turkey. You just had to do it within the confines of your home. And keep in mind, the wealthy, when they knew that the Volstead Act was going to be implemented in 1920, stocked up, as they say, and many of them had very nice wine cellars during those 13, 14 years almost that we had Prohibition.
We're talking about the 80th anniversary of the repeal of Prohibition in 1933, Prohibition in this country from 1920 until 1933, in this state from 1916 until 1933. Tim Walsh is with us, historian. We have some audio that we'd like to play here because we have Iowans, plenty of people who remember this time as youngsters here. And Templeton Rye, people know Templeton Rye whiskey these days. On their website, they have a project. It's called the Templeton Rye Archive Project, and there are posted many testimonials from people who remember firsthand, sometimes secondhand, but a lot of them firsthand, of the period of Prohibition. Let's listen to one gentleman, Bob Hoffman. He tells the stories of his childhood growing up in Templeton, Iowa. This is in western Iowa, during the Prohibition era. And let's listen to this clip of Bob Hoffman. In this story, he talks about how a sheriff had the best rye whiskey because he would confiscate evidence and sell it later. And according to this story, which we'll see, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, he would also have people in jail flatten the copper materials used for brewing to make copper roofs. Let's listen. This is Bob Hoffman from the Templeton Rye Archive Project.
I don't know whether it's an urban myth or whether it's fact that if you wanted to buy the best rye, you had to go to the Carroll County Sheriff. The sheriff would go out and raid a bootlegger. He'd confiscate all of the inventory that the guy had. Of course, he had to have it for evidence. And then we found out later that evidence was always for sale. Then he also took all the copper that the guy had with his still, and he took that back to the jail, and he had the guys in jail flattening the stuff out. And I can take you today to two houses that still have the copper roofs on that he built back then. So anyway, It was a great, great time.
Bob Hoffman from the Templeton Rye Archive Project. We posted a link to the Templeton Rye Archive Project, their YouTube channel, on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Tim Walsh, does that surprise you that
the
authorities were in on this?
Well, there's another story about a sheriff named Frank Christian in Winneshiek County who couldn't figure out where those stills were being hidden. And he went out to one farm, and there was a whole series of beehives. And he finally realized there's one hive there that doesn't have any bees swarming around it. He opened it up, and of course, it had a 5-gallon still in it. So people looked for ways, ingenious ways, to distill whiskey and then ship it to, in the case of, say, Templeton, which was geographically situated in a perfect location between, say, Chicago and Kansas City, you know, you literally wanted to supply your markets. And so they created a sub rosa, illegal a form of commerce based on fast automobiles. The other thing we should always remember, too, is smuggling. Canada was not dry. And so Seagram's and other distilleries in Canada produced vast quantities of liquor that was then shipped by fast boat, kind of the early days of the so-called cigarette boat, those speed boats, across the Detroit River. And so then there'd be shootouts between police and slower boats with crooks and criminals, smugglers and bootleggers with
It's as if you could be talking about the modern era and we just changed the drug.
It and the border. They're not coming up from Mexico. It's coming down from Canada. There's a wonderful little quip, and let me just read this quickly, from 1919. This is a little doggerel. 4-20 Yankees, feeling very dry, went across the border to get a drink of rye. When the rye was opened, the Yanks began to sing, "God bless America, but God save the king." So people wanted their alcohol, and they were going to get it. It was a noble experiment, but it was a failed experiment.
Let's go back to listen to a little bit of Bob Hoffman, his remembrances as part of the Templeton Rye Archive Project. You'll be amused by this, because many of the testimonies we have are from older people now who were children at that time. This is Bob's personal account of how he would steal rye whiskey from a secret hiding spot as a kid and sell it on the street for money. Let's listen.
We would find, we knew where any number of these guys were hiding their stock of rye, and any number of times we would be a little bit broke, but in those days, who wasn't broke, and especially kids, and we'd liberate a gallon of Templeton rye, and we always knew somebody on the street that was ready, willing, and able to give us a dollar and a half. And I'm telling you, for a bunch of 9-10-year-old snot-nosed kids, you know, a buck and a half was all the money in the world.
Bob Hoffman, a native of Templeton, Iowa, talking about Prohibition era, remembering 80 years since its repeal. Illegal whiskey made on farms in northwest Iowa, the small town of Templeton in western Iowa. This reddish-colored Templeton rye, popular in speakeasies. You mentioned that, Tim, across the country from Chicago to Kansas City to New York City. I wonder, because you are such a presidential historian focused on Herbert Hoover, his entire administration, his 4 years, took place during Prohibition. How did he deal with it?
Well, the law was the law for Herbert Hoover, and although he enjoyed martinis late in life, we tell this story, you repeated it for me earlier, the idea was when he was told he could only have one martini a day, he said, "Well, get me a bigger glass." So he was a man who enjoyed a good drink, particularly in the evening, but during Prohibition, no liquor was served in the White House. In fact, the story is that he had quite a wine cellar, and when Prohibition passed in 1920, he had all that wine destroyed because he didn't want to be seen as a hypocrite. So even though he was allowed legally to have that wine and could have consumed it, he chose not to. But he also invoked the Wickersham Commission, the Attorney General's office to investigate whether or not Prohibition was really an effective form of control of alcohol. And the commission's records actually are out at the Hoover Library. I think Hoover was ambivalent. I think he had traveled the world. He understood that alcohol had its place, but he also understood the impulse to control it. And many of the people who had voted for him in 1928 were obviously advocates of prohibition, and he followed the law.
Ed is joining us from Robbins. A quick call. Ed, we're coming up on a break. What do you want to chip into our conversation?
Well, I don't think most people realize that before the 16th Amendment, the single biggest source of federal revenue was the tax on alcohol. And once the federal government could get into our pocketbooks through an income tax, they were a lot more willing to consider, as they did in 1920, the fact that alcohol would be illegal.
Very interesting. Ed, thank you for that, chipping that in from Robbins. We're going to come back in just a few minutes and talk more with Tim Walch about the repeal of Prohibition, what it was like here in Iowa, and also we're going to talk about Bonnie and Clyde. 1933, a big shootout that involved Bonnie and Clyde right here in Iowa. We'll be back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
You better make it to the woods if you can. If you can, if you can.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll hear about a famous shootout that involved Bonnie and Clyde right here in Iowa in the town of Dexter with a historian. In just a moment, we'll be talking with historian Rod Stanley about it's his hometown. He grew up hearing these stories, and he became fascinated in it. And we'll hear about the shootout in Dexter, Iowa. But let's finish up our conversation with historian Tim Walch, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim is with us in the studio. We're talking about the 80th anniversary this month of the repeal of Prohibition between 1920 1933. Liquor was illegal to... you said you could make it for your home use, Tim?
For home use. You could not brew or distill spirits for package and resale. And, of course, that obviously was somewhat prejudiced in the sense that it meant that although if you had a vineyard or you could acquire grapes, you could make it for your own personal consumption. Many people in Iowa, I'm told, with a wink and a nod, were making bathtub gin. There was concern, of course, with anything that was homebrew, moonshine or whatever you might want to call it, because, of course, it wasn't regulated or it wasn't inspected, and there were illnesses associated with it. So, you know, you're consuming something that might be akin to poison because you don't know where it came from or who actually brewed it. But people had a deep and powerful thirst, and so they were buying, whether it's Templeton rye or they were buying moonshine in a mason jar, they were buying that liquor, and they were making organized criminals like, Al Capone, wealthy in the process.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned how popular this was when it began in 1920. Here's a quote from the great journalist H.L. Mencken from 1925. So this is 5 years after the nation has been in Prohibition, and I want to have you comment about this and the way in which public opinion or opinions came to go against Prohibition. He wrote in 1925, 5 years of Prohibition have had at least this one benign effect. They have completely disposed of all the favorite arguments of the Prohibitionists. None of the great boons and usufructs that were to follow the passage of the 18th Amendment has come to pass. There is not less drunkenness in the Republic, but more. There is not less crime, but more. There is not less insanity, but more. The cost of government is not smaller, but vastly greater. Respect for law has not increased, but diminished.
That last phrase, respect for law has not increased, but diminished, I think is absolutely true. And of course, Mencken loved a good phrase and often used words that nobody else understood.
Like usufructs.
Usufructs, that's right. Whatever. We had to look that up. Reminiscent of Bill Buckley in his vocabulary. What's interesting is there were some positive elements to the control and prohibition of alcohol. Cirrhosis of the liver did go down. down in the 1920s. But historians today still argue whether or not it had the impact, because there were so many promises made about increased productivity and a more godly lifestyle. I mean, whenever you try to regulate a social vice like this, you you run into potential conflict. So it's still a controversial subject.
So talk about the end game for prohibition in this country. It was repealed in 1933,
Franklin,
80 years
right,
ago. So how did it come to be?
Franklin
reversed?
Roosevelt, of course, is elected on March in November, of 1932. He is inaugurated president on March 5th. By the end of March, he's passed or signed into law a new act which basically modifies the Volstead Act. The Volstead Act was the regulations that controlled how much alcoholic beverage and how much alcohol could be in these beverages, and he increased it to allow for the brewing of 3-2 beer. So when you see those pictures shortly after Roosevelt's inauguration, it's 3-2 alcohol that people are consuming. They then implement the whole process of repealing the 18th Amendment, and by December 5th of 1933, we have repealed the 18th Amendment. It's the only time in our history where we've used an amendment to repeal an amendment. So the 21st repeals the 18th.
You're a historian, Tim Walsh, and I know sometimes historians don't like to venture too far into the present day, but it's not hard to see parallels between the repeal of prohibition, as we reflect on prohibition, and the legalization of marijuana sales, Colorado,
sure,
Washington State, particularly the fact that criminalization in the case of alcohol never really stopped the use of it. Instead, it forced it underground, creating this unregulated black market. A valid point.
What's interesting is apparently if you were caught bootlegging or brewing, you were charged a $500 fine or you had to go to jail. And I'm told that there are as many as 20,000 people who were incarcerated for bootlegging at the end of the 1920s. So, yes, it was very clear statistically that this wasn't going to work. What is interesting about this whole discussion about marijuana and alcohol is to remember that the states have a role in this, and so that states themselves can continue to regulate. And just like Maine and Kansas and Iowa had prohibition of alcohol in 1916, states like California and Colorado and others can allow for the sale of medical marijuana, and it is going to be left up to the states to some extent on issues like marijuana. I'm sure the law enforcement community is not necessarily in favor of it, but regulating a social vice, so to speak, like that is very difficult to do. We're people who were born in liberty, and we like our freedom.
Okay, Tim Walsh, we'll leave it there. Historian Tim Walsh, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Always fascinating to have you in the studio, tying the history of decades ago into the present.
Well, I'll drink to that, Ben.
All right. We'll give you a holiday toast maybe in a few days. Tim Walsh, thanks again. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's stay in 1933. Why not? It's been fun the first part of this hour. Why shouldn't it be to talk about Bonnie and Clyde in 1933. A new Bonnie and Clyde miniseries appeared on cable TV this month, in a broadcast on the History, A&E, and Lifetime channels.
You know what's funny? Bonnie never told me exactly how to keep her happy. She never told me one last job wouldn't be enough. I could have stopped it. I should have.
That's Emil Hirsch, lead actor there. Bonnie Elizabeth Parker, Clyde Chestnut Barrel, well-known murderers, American outlaws, robbers, criminals. They came from the Dallas area, but they traveled to the central part of the United States with their gang during the Great Depression. And as it turns out, they came here to Iowa as well. Joining me now to talk about a famous Iowa shootout involving Bonnie and Clyde, Rod Stanley is in our Des Moines studio, historian and retired school teacher from Dexter, Iowa. Rod, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, great to have you with us. I understand you now live in Panora. You grew up, though, in Dexter.
Yeah, I grew up in Dexter back in the 50s and the 60s and heard a lot of stories about the Barrel Gang. Really wasn't that interested in it at that time, but there were a lot of people that I knew that either took part in a posse on that July day, or you know, had seen the Barrel Gang in downtown Dexter. So,
let's start before this battle that happened. Is it called the Dex Field Battle?
You know, it was actually at a campground at an old amusement park. There was an amusement park that was located north of Dexter. That's another story in itself. It was built in 1915, and it was the largest amusement park in the state of Iowa. And there was a campground there, and that's where Bonnie and Clyde were camped out at.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what brought them to Iowa in the first place?
I think it was because people in Iowa didn't know who they were, and they could come and go pretty much as they pleased. I mean, when they came to Dexter in July of 1933, they were out at this campground for like three or four days, and I mean, they made trips into town and bought things and bought groceries and bought medicines and clothing and so on. And, you know, the people in Dexter enjoyed their money. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. So turned a blind eye maybe a little bit?
They didn't know who they were.
Oh, they didn't know who they were.
No, they had no idea. I mean, there might have been posters up in the post office, but not many people, I think, when they went into the post office during the Depression, was looking at wanted posters.
Mm-hmm. So how did there come to be a shootout? What happened?
Like I said, they had come up from Platte City, Missouri, where they had been involved in another shootout. And Brother Buck, who was portrayed in that miniseries, he had a severe head wound. He had part of his head blown off. But
Buck Barrel,
right. And him and his wife and Bonnie and Clyde and a teenager was running with him by the name of W.D. Jones. And they came up from Platte City after that shootout up Highway 169 and through Adel and Winterset and so on and down the White Pole Road to Dexter and then north. This campground was about 3 miles north of Dexter. And it was way off the road, probably a half mile, three-quarters of a mile off the road in very thick timber and underbrush. And they came there to rest and to recover and to treat Buck's head wound.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what happened then? Some contact with some locals?
Like I said, they were there for like 3 or 4 days, and they made trips into town. They were found out. There was a fellow that was out there, a guy by the name of Henry Nye. And Henry Nye is a distant relative of mine. I didn't really know him. He was a lot older than I. But he was out there hunting blackberries one day, and he came across the barrel campsite, and he found all these bloodied bandages and shirts and so on. And it kind of scared him, and he went back to his house, and he called the town constable, a fellow by the name of John Love. And John and Henry went back out there. When Henry was out there, I might add that the barrel gang wasn't around. If they would have been, probably they might have taken him hostage, or they might have stopped and talked to him and asked him what he was doing and so on. But, you know, the barrel gang was up. Actually, at that time, they were up in Perry, Iowa, and they were stealing a car. Hmm. And they actually did steal another V8 Ford. And Clyde loved V8 Fords. Because they were fast. They could go 90 miles an hour, and he could tinker with them enough that they'd even go faster. But they were actually up in Perry when Henry Nye found their campsite. But Henry called John Love, and then eventually John Love called the county sheriff, a fellow by the name of Clint Nee. And on that Sunday evening, Clint Nee came over to Dexter, and they organized a posse, not knowing. They thought it might be the barrel gang. They didn't know for sure, but they thought it might be, and they organized a posse of about probably 50 people, and it was from all different towns around Dexter, from Adel, from Stewart, from Jamaica, from Redfield, and a lot of people showed up, and they organized themselves to go out there the next morning, which would have been a Monday morning, like at 5 a.m. in the morning, to rouse this group of five people.
What happened during the actual battle then?
They went out there, actually sent people out the night before, and they blocked this long driveway out of this campground so that they decided to leave, and then they blocked the bridge across the South Raccoon River. I don't know how many they sent, probably 4 or 5 guys out there. Then the next morning they went out there, and actually there was a couple fellas from Des Moines that kind of took over the posse from Clint Nee, a fellow by the name of Rags Riley, who was a state policeman. And I can't remember right offhand who the other guys, but Rags Riley was kind of the guy that took charge. And they surrounded this campsite like on 3 sides and basically came in. And when they started coming in towards the campsite, all 5 of the barrel gang were up. Buck and Blanche were on a car seat that they had pulled out of the car, and Bonnie and Clyde were there. And W.D. Jones was actually roasting a hot dog on the campfire.
Right.
And they got close enough. And Clyde and Bonnie had saw some movement in the brush and so on. And Clyde figured something was up. And this Rags Riley hollered at him and said, "Put down your weapons and put up your hands." And, yeah, Clyde picked up a Browning automatic rifle, which was his favorite weapon, which they had stolen out of federal arsenals along the way. And he fired a blast over the heads of these this posse. If he would have wanted to kill some people, then he probably could have, because there were several people right in his sights. But all he wanted was time to get into the car, which they did get into one of the cars. They started down the long driveway to get out, and he was turning the car, backing the car up, and he got shot in the shoulder, and backed it over a stump, and got it hung up. And so they got out of that car and ran back to the other car, which had already been shot to pieces by this posse. And that's when they took off, and Buck and Blanche were kind of left behind.
Mm-hmm. So how many of the gang made it out?
Bonnie and Clyde and W.D. Jones. Buck and Blanche, eventually they got caught, and there are a lot of capture pictures. I mean, Buck, like I said, had a severe head wound. He had part of his skull that was blown away. In fact, the doctors that treated him and Dexter, I mean, they said that you could see his brain. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could see it. It was there. But he was in pretty bad shape, and he also had gotten shot during the shootout. I might say that, you know, Bonnie got shot that day out there. Clyde got shot three times. W.D. Jones, the teenager, got shot at least three times. And they still were able to run down the hill towards the river, cross the river, and up to a farmhouse where they eventually made their escape.
If you just joined us, Rod Stanley is with us, historian, a native of Dexter, Iowa, now lives in Panora, recalling a famous shootout involving Bonnie and Clyde in 1933. You may have caught maybe some of the new Bonnie and Clyde miniseries appearing on cable TV this month. So have you, Rod Stanley, been out to this site, this abandoned amusement park?
Oh,
is
yeah.
there anything there today?
There's nothing there about the amusement park. I mean, the Dexter Historical Society, which the museum in Dexter has a lot of artifacts, and I encourage anyone that's interested in finding out more about Bonnie and Clyde and so on to come out to Dexter and take a look at the museum. But there's some markers out there that they put up about the shootout and about the amusement park. There's nothing there in the amusement park except a flat field. And the campsite is on private property, but I've been out there several times. I mean, as far as, you know, in fact, I've given programs out at the campsite. It's kind of fun to go out there and imagine what Bonnie and Clyde and W.D. Jones and Buck and Blanche felt when they saw those people coming in on them and then start shooting. And I would imagine, as a posse member, what it was like to be shot at with a Browning automatic rifle and 30-06 shells too. Mm-hmm. So,
Bonnie and Clyde eventually ambushed and killed, I believe, in Louisiana by some law officers, but their reputation revived, cemented in American pop folklore from that 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde, starring Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty as the two, the famous duo there. Let's listen to a little bit of audio of actors from this new cable TV series reflecting, among them Holly Hunter we'll hear too, reflecting on why this story continues to captivate our imagination.
You've read the story of Jesse James, of how he lived and died. If you're still in need of something to read, here's the story of Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde is still popular today because it's been so romanticized. It's kind of glamorous in a way, the criminals on the run, two lovers, and I think people find it to be a fantasy of some sort.
At that period of time, people were screaming for entertainment. People were starved for a moment of release from their own discomfort, from their pain of the hardship of their lives. And Bonnie and Clyde offered a certain respite from that with this, like, danger. What are we capable of? And we like to see that, as long as we don't have to do it ourselves. This is why people like movies. What could happen that's not happening to us, but there's a vicarious kind of thrill that I think was absolutely going on.
Holly Hunter there reflecting on the new miniseries on Bonnie and Clyde she's taken part in on History, A&E, and Lifetime channels, reflecting on Bonnie and Clyde in Iowa with Rod Stanley. When we talk about the allure, the captivation that this story and this couple holds for us, Rod Stanley, what do you think is at the heart of it? We heard Holly Hunter there.
I think a lot of it. I mean, they were young. I mean, they were 23 and 24 when they got killed in Gibson, Louisiana. I think a lot of people identified with them. It was during the Depression, and they were robbing banks. They robbed more than banks. I mean, they robbed gas stations and things like that. But, you know, a lot of these banks had foreclosed on a lot of people. I think people identify with that. I think some of them looked at it as a Robin Hood thing, mm-hmm. or robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. But I can tell you this, I can only know of one incident where Clyde Barrow ever gave any money to the poor. So they gave a lot of it to their own families, I think. But, I mean, it was just something that people could read about, and I think some of them identified with them.
Tim Walsh, our presidential historian, is still with us, Rod Stanley. He's listening in a delighted fashion about your recantation of this shootout. Tim Walsh, what did you want to chip in?
Well, I just wanted to add that it's not only Bonnie and Clyde, but it's also Henry Ford. I mean, Clyde so loved Ford Motors and the V8 that he offered to, in fact, write a letter to Henry Ford offering to endorse Ford V8s for their advertising, but Henry Ford never took them out on it. The letter actually is in the Ford archives.
Interesting. Rod Stanley, as a child, you grew up in Dexter, Iowa.
Yep.
You knew people who had actually come across Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, yeah. And there's still a lady that's alive. She's one of my mother's best. My mother still lives in Dexter, and she's in the nursing home. She was actually, you know, I was telling about Henry and I finding that campsite, but she was actually in a Girl Scout troop that was camping out at the old Dexfield Park and actually marched through Bonnie and Clyde's camp when they were there. And this
what do they remember about that camp?
She remembers that there were people sitting around the campfire. There was five people, and actually the leader of the Girl Scout troop was my Aunt Della Gowdy, and she said that Aunt Della was leading them through there, and and basically I said, well, what'd they look like when they saw you guys? And they said they had a very surprised look on their face, but she said that they didn't say anything to them, said, good morning, girls, how's it going? And that was about it. But she said that she had seen Bonnie and Clyde in downtown Dexter, not knowing who they were. She said that she remembers once she saw Clyde and Bonnie. Clyde was sitting on the fender of the car and eating an ice cream cone, and Bonnie was in the car, and Maxine thought it was kind of rude that the guy was eating the ice cream and the girl didn't have any. That's what her thought was, but she didn't have any idea about whether it was who it was and who she was dealing with there.
We have just about a minute left, but you've given many, many talks about Iowa's connection to Bonnie and Clyde. Rod Stanley, when you give those talks, what aspects do you think do you find most people seem most surprised or stunned by?
Oh, I they're just interested in about the two people and about the shootout in Dexter, and I find that they're really interested in finding out that Bonnie and Clyde spent a lot of time in Iowa. I mean, they were here quite a bit.
Rod Stanley, thank you so much for telling us all about it. Historian, retired school teacher from Dexter, Iowa, now living in Panora. Rod Stanley, fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
She loved him, though he was talking. He took her down to Chinatown, and he showed her how to kick the gong.